Okay, so don't forget, I am recording the lecture right now, and if you don't want me to record the lectures, you have to let me know this week in writing. Otherwise, sometime soon, I'll develop a page on my website and start dumping the lectures there for you to download. Okay, you could probably stream them off that site, but it's not a streaming server. So the best thing for you to do is to download the lecture, and you do that by right-clicking, and then save target as, save it to your hard drive. And the same thing for the videos in this class as well. Let's see if it keeps getting louder the whole time. So you notice in course documents right here, I did get an email on this, right? In course documents, you see a number of videos right here, nephron videos, vertebrate, and let's see what else we got, microscope tutorial right here. And it's a WMV file, so it should play in Windows Media Player pretty nicely. But it all depends on what version of Windows Media Player you have. Sometimes you get the video playing nicely, sometimes the audio without the video, sometimes the video without the audio. There's a program that works every single time I've tried it with just about any formatted movie, MPEGs, Flash files, WMV files, and it's called DVIX. So and a student was having trouble playing this, streaming this off the server. So what I would do is I would right-click on this link, save it to your hard drive so it doesn't have to stream off the server, right? And then I would go get a reliable media player. And the most reliable media player that I've run into, there's a couple newer ones out there, is if we go into course information, and here are plugins right here, I would download the DVIX video player for you, for yourself. Download it to your hard drive. It doesn't load a bunch of spyware, adware on your computer. It's very powerful. It doesn't take a lot of computer system resources. And it has worked every single time for a video file that I downloaded. And once you get this as an icon on your desktop, okay, you can just drag and drop the icon of whatever video file you want to play on top of the DVIX player, and it will run for you. Right, as long as you have a headset or speakers, you'll be able to hear it. I don't have DVIX loaded on this computer. Maybe if I have time after lecture, I'll go ahead and set this computer up to do that. You can see how I would mouse around to do that. Should be pretty easy. I think if you go to DVIX over here, it will talk with your computer and even tell you what version you need, whether it's a Mac or PC or whatever. It should be pretty simple to do that. So I know in lab, I always use a DVIX player to show videos in lab. Okay. If you want to talk to me after class about your particular problem, I'd be happy to show you some more about that. All right, but that information is in Blackboard. Okay, the slide on the right over here is our schedule. And you notice that our next lecture, which is on September 3rd, is what? Replaced by something. A test? No, not a test. It's a holiday. All right, so Labor Day holiday. Please don't come to school. And then we're going to start a new chapter on Wednesday, which is tissue. So we're going to get through cells mostly, but I might have to talk about some cells on Wednesday as well. So you should be keeping up with your pre-lecture reading assignments. Go ahead, hold them up for me. Anybody doing them? Oh, nice, 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 nice. You know, that will make, it's a little bit of effort, but it will make your life easier if you do that ahead of time. It will really help you. All right, and don't forget, our first exam is on a Wednesday, September 19th. It's a couple weeks away, but it's not that far away to where you should not study every day. You still should be studying every day in this class, working on the pre-lecture reading assignments, reviewing the pre-lecture reading assignments, reviewing the end of chapter questions, reviewing the questions that are in Blackboard. Okay. Now, I did forget something that is going to happen before Labor Day. That's important. What's going to happen before Labor Day that's important for you? You can earn course points for it. Yeah, the online quiz. When is that going to be due?
Friday at
11 p.m. That's right. So make sure you get that. And in Blackboard, you'll see that it has a nice dollar sign right there, so you can zoom right into it. Question? Okay, I won't post the answer to those. Yeah. So if we go into, I think I might have, pre-lecture reading assignments. So maybe I'll change the spelling of that button. Okay. If you have this folder that's available to you, pre-lecture homework answer keys. And if you click it, okay, here are all the answer keys, but they only open up after lecture. So they're pre-programmed to open up. So the first one opened up after the first lecture. This one will open up sometime during lecture. I don't know what time I put in there. Can we go check the, let's go check the time. When, all right, so it's programmed to open up at 12 p.m., okay, which is in a little less than an hour. It will open up for you. So you can check the way that I'm thinking my correct answers. Your answers might be close, all right, and it's a correct answer, but probably you want to get a feel for exactly how I'm thinking about a particular question. And some questions might have more than one correct answer, and I'd be happy to talk to you about any of the questions that are in the pre-lecture reading assignment. The questions that are in the end of chapter have answers in the back of your book, and all the online questions that you submit as practice will be graded, and you can tell what the correct answer is for those as well from the textbook publisher, right? So you can get a lot of good feedback before you take an exam in here. So you should be knowing how your study time is going just by taking all these pre-lecture assignments and online quizzes, end of chapter questions and things like that. So you can get a feel for how you might do on that first exam. So there's no reason why somebody should get a zero on that first exam, right? Because you'll be getting feedback if you do all those weekly assignments. Okay, so going back to the schedule over here, you got the lecture exam, and then in lab after the lecture exam, the week after, we have the first practicum. And you just tool up for those practicums in lab. So I'll speak about the practicums in lab. All right, any questions about Blackboard so far or the schedule? Things like that. Oh, somebody did have a question about the practicums. I did put them on the lecture schedule right here, so you can see how it superimposes on the lecture schedule, but you also have them in the lab schedule. So here's the Monday group, 1, 2, 3, 4 practicums. Here's the Wednesday group, 1, 2, 3, 4 practicums as well. All right, so you get both schedules ready to go. Okay, any questions on Blackboard? Now, it's really important for everybody to make sure that you can log into Blackboard this week. All right, so if you're having problems with that, then you got to see me right after class, and we got to work with your password or do something so you have access, because don't forget that deadline for the first online quiz is Friday. And I would, over the weekend, since it's a nice long weekend, I would get maybe 3 weeks ahead in terms of those online quizzes. All right, and then if you get ahead on those quizzes, you're never going to get gypped out of points because the computer doesn't work like 2 or 3 minutes before 11 o'clock some Friday evening, right? Plus, you might not want to really work on these quizzes Friday evening. I'm not sure. Sometimes it's quiet. Maybe everybody leaves the house, leaves you alone, okay, to study. But get all those quizzes done as fast as you can, okay? Then you'll never miss a deadline. All right, we were going to finish up with body cavities. I think maybe we talked a little bit about body cavities. We certainly did in lab. And as a matter of fact, this lateral view right here, part of this lateral view of body cavities is an extra credit drawing at the end of lab for today's, or this week's lab. All right, so when we look at a body, all right, we see this lateral view, but we could also consider this an imaging plane. Right, we can make a picture with an MRI unit or a CT scanner of this view of the inside of somebody's body without actually cutting them open, which is really, really nice. And what kind of view would this be according to the standard imaging planes that you're familiar with? Okay. What? How many standard imaging planes are there? There are three. That wasn't really loud, you guys. Okay, but there are three. Go ahead and tell me. Three. What are the names of the three? Sagittal. I heard transverse. And frontal or coronal like this. All right, so you got coronal, transverse, sagittal. What view would this be right here? Sagittal. And I see the tip of this person's nose right here, so that kind of leads me to believe that that's right smack in the middle. So that has a special name too. What would we call the special name of that sagittal? Mid-sagittal. Sometimes your book maybe calls it median. All right, so don't forget, in anatomy, sometimes there's more than one correct term for an item or a view or whatever. And a lot of times these things are copyrighted or trademarked, so if one company, like General Electric, makes a MRI imager and says this is a sagittal plane, and if they copyright this as sagittal, then another instrument maker can't use that without paying royalties to the first company. So they might come up with another name. That's how coronal and frontal got developed. Okay, so sometimes these are trade names, but they're important anatomical terms. Superficially in the body, we have muscle and we have bones, and there's no body cavities in that part of your body. We call that the soma of your body, and it doesn't contain organs. It just has muscles and bones. But deep to muscle and bones, we do have special cavities that contain viscera or organs. All right, so these are visceral cavities. And in the back, what are some anatomical terms that we can use to refer to the back of somebody in anatomic position? Posterior or dorsal, exactly the same term, right? So sometimes we call these the dorsal body cavities, and the dorsal body cavity is made up of two cavities, and the superior one is the cranial cavity because there are bones within the head that make the cranium, and that's just an armor plating for what organ? The brain, that's right. Cranial cavity holds the brain. It's a visceral organ. And the vertebral cavity right here running through the vertebral column, these are armor plates that protect the spinal cord. But there's got to be a cavity there that the spinal cord fits into, and that's the vertebral cavity. All right, so I could ask you on the test, the vertebral cavity and cranial cavity make up what cavity? Dorsal cavity. Or maybe I could ask you to break down the dorsal cavity. Or maybe I'll even put this figure on the test just for fun, right? And then there's going to be a word bank, and you just match the proper terms to the proper cavity. All right, so that's with a nice lateral view. Oh, we forgot this other big cavity. The ventral body cavity has other smaller cavities in it. Superiorly is a thoracic cavity. Then we have a nice strong muscle here called the diaphragm, important for inspiration. That's how we inhale. And then inferior to the diaphragm, we have the abdominal cavity, and then even inferior to that, we have the pelvic cavity. Abdominal and pelvic cavity really is one cavity together, right? It's just a mental construct of about where our hip bones are, which is lateral. They're not inside the pelvic cavity. We can kind of consider this the pelvic cavity right here. So sometimes we want to talk about the abdominal pelvic cavity together because they really are one cavity. How would we do that? We would put these words together as long as we put an O between them. We would say abdominal pelvic cavity. I know it kind of sounds like I'm saying abdominal pelvic cavity, but that's not it. So what? Abdominal pelvic cavity. Maybe it's, oh, here it is spelled out for you perfectly right over here. Abdominal pelvic cavity. All right, so the abdominal pelvic cavity is broken down into the abdominal and the pelvic cavity. Sometimes we call that the peritoneal cavity. That's another important term that you should be aware of. Peritoneal is exactly the same as abdominopelvic. And that thoracic cavity can be broken down into subcavities as well. The cavities that your lungs are in are called pleural cavities. You have a right and left, like your right and left lung don't touch each other. And they're separated by another cavity that's in the middle. We call that the mediastinum. Mediastinum. Mediastinum contains your heart and great blood vessels coming off the base of the heart. A couple other little organs in this region too, but the great blood vessels and the heart are the most important in the mediastinum. So this area is imaged routinely and often in the hospital because people have problems with their hearts and blood vessels coming off the heart, especially congenital malformations when somebody's born. We notice that right away, and we've got to find out what that malformation is and correct it before that person dies if it's severe enough. All right, so, and then we can break the mediastinum down into this inferior compartment right here that just has the heart in it. That's called the pericardial cavity. The pericardial cavity. So anytime you hear cardial, guess what you should be thinking of? Or cardium, like myocardium refers to the heart. Myo means muscle, cardium means heart. Myocardium really means heart muscle. And then in common everyday usage, we use myocardium to signify the heart as well. Okay, and there are different parts of the myocardium. Here's the superior mediastinum for those big, gigantic blood vessels that attach to the heart. So it's a really important cavity. All right, I'm sure you have drag and drop exercises, some kind of labeling exercises in Blackboard to practice this. And this diagram here, without what's in the parentheses, is part of your diagram in lab for this week. Extra credit. All right, any questions on these body cavities? That should be pretty easy to work with in Blackboard, okay? All right, so here's just the zoomed-in region of the two different presentations. Oh, but I forgot to ask you, what kind of imaging plane would give you a view of the human body like this? Frontal or coronal? Yeah, exactly right, okay. And what kind of plane would separate a superior from an inferior part in your body? Yeah, a transverse, really good. All right, so that's pretty good for this chapter. What you don't have in your lecture notes But I think I'm going to talk about it right now are some membranes, because it's presented in this particular chapter. And maybe I'll write some stuff on the board. All right, but I'm going to talk about this figure first. So here you have, here is a balloon. And let's take this guy's hand out of the balloon. How many surfaces exist on a balloon that you just have in your hands? You just have one surface, right? The outside of the balloon, you got some air on the outside, you got some air on the inside that's at a little bit higher pressure, so it fills the balloon up. So that's just one continuous membrane, right, the balloon. Right? And if the balloon is not super full, you can take your finger or your hand and push it inside the balloon without breaking it. Okay? And of course, it's still just one continuous piece of rubber, but there are now two different parts to that balloon. There's one that's on the outside that's touching air, and there's another part that has been folded into the balloon that is touching your hand that I see right here. So here's the outer wall of the balloon, and now here is that inner wall of the balloon, but you realize it's what? Continuous. But because it's in two different locations, we might want to talk about it because it really is in two different locations. Even though it's the same balloon, this part of the balloon is in a different spot than this one right here. So all of our viscera have this sort of arrangement with a membrane around the internal organs. Let's look at the heart first. Right, this kind of membrane that lines an internal organ is what we call a serous membrane that is in a serous cavity. It's got three parts to it. It's got the outer membrane, it's got the inner membrane, and guess what it has between them? A space, right? It's got a serous space right here, and it's filled with serous fluid, a watery fluid of some kind. All right, let's take a look. All right, so here is the heart. And I'm going to lose my arrow if I make it bigger. Let's see if I can tell you what's happening here. Maybe if you see the colors, it will help you. Here is the outer wall of the balloon. All right. Now, what cavity is the heart in? The pericardium, right? So this is a pericardial membrane. It's a pericardial serous membrane. This part that's the outer part of the membrane is called the parietal pericardium. It means it's on the outside. And it's continuous. When it bumps into the heart, then it folds down to the inside and is actually touching the heart. It's actually the same membrane as out over here, but it's really touching the heart. So it's in a different location. And so we call this the visceral pericardium. Visceral because it's touching that visceral organ. All right, so here's a pericardium layer. Here's a pericardium layer. Parietal is on the outside. The visceral division is touching the organ, which is the heart. All right, so we call that the pericardium. And then here is that space between the parietal and visceral divisions of the pericardium, and it's filled with serous fluid. And that serous fluid allows the heart to beat, and your heart is actually beating very violently inside your chest, and that serous fluid allows for that motion without inflammation developing, which is really important. Sometimes you can get an inflammation of this space right here. It fills up with fluid. Maybe it could be due to a viral infection, bacterial infection, or just some kind of mechanical disruption of the heart. Certainly it can happen very easily right after surgery. And if the pericardial cavity fills up with fluid, could you think about what might happen to the heart right here? Right? Instead of being maybe 1 centimeter thick, maybe it becomes 5 centimeters thick. Okay, what happens to the function of the heart when that happens then? Okay, it decreases because in order for the heart to pump blood, guess what has to happen? It's got to fill up with blood first. And if that serous cavity is so big that the heart can't fill up with blood, the heart might be contracting just perfectly, but there's no blood in there for it to pump, and that doesn't do your body any good. Okay, that condition is what we call pericarditis. And fortunately, it's really easy to fix in a hurry. You just jab a needle in this space right here and suck that fluid out, and you might sound like that. You might feel like that patient will be very disagreeable when that happens, but they'll feel so good they'll thank you if you do that, okay? Because they'll have much better cardiac function. All right. There's another serous membrane. Here are the lungs, and on the surface of the lung, this is the pleural cavity, right? And this is a serous cavity as well. And here is the visceral membrane that's right on the surface of the lungs. It's actually touching the lungs. Here is the pleural space, And then here is the parietal division of the pleural membrane. All right, so here's the parietal pleura. Here is the visceral pleura. Can you see a little red line right here? Is it sort of red? I don't know what color it is, green. But you see two different divisions, but remember that those membranes are continuous with each other. It's just that the parietal is on the body wall, the visceral is right on the surface of the organ, and there's some space between them, filled with serous fluid. And this membrane can become inflamed. Anybody know what that's called? Maybe I asked some groups, I can't remember. It's called pleurisy. And when it's inflamed, then it's very difficult, it's very painful to inflate the lungs. And when somebody has pleurisy, they don't feel like breathing because it feels like somebody's stabbing them in the chest with a knife. Okay? Now, what's worse, getting stabbed in the chest or holding your breath forever? That's a really difficult decision. It's no fun not breathing, right? And then when you breathe, you feel like you're being stabbed in the chest. So these patients are just in a really bad mood, right? So how can we treat somebody in intractable pain like that? So much pain that they can't even breathe. Opiates take the pain away for them, right? So there are proper uses for pretty stiff drugs, and that would be a really good reason to use it. Here's the sign-in sheet for today. I'm going to pass around. So this is your receipt for being in class. Sign it. It's not alphabetical order or anything, but I'll get an alphabetical order soon. Please don't put your student number or anything like that on there. It's just your name is fine. Okay. All right, so that's two serous membranes, one around the heart, which is the one we call the one that's around the heart. Pericardial membrane, the one around the lungs is the pleural membrane. And then there's some other cavities that are in the ventral body cavity, like what? The abdominal pelvic cavity. Another name for abdominal pelvic cavity is peritoneal cavity. And the membrane that surrounds the peritoneal cavity is the peritoneum. And I have a transverse section of the peritoneal serous membrane. Here is an organ right here. Here's a liver. This is a good one. Let's look at the liver. That's a visceral organ. Right on the surface of the liver is the visceral peritoneum. Right on the abdominal wall is the parietal peritoneum. And here's that space between the visceral and parietal peritoneum that contains serous fluid. And that's just the peritoneal space. It contains serous fluid. Okay, so here is the peritoneum right here. And so I'm kind of outlining the margin of the peritoneum. I have a couple other very important organs that are in the same region right here. And these are the kidneys. Okay, but notice that they are posterior to the peritoneal membrane right here. And since they're behind the peritoneum, we call these retroperitoneal. Retro means behind in this particular case. That will make a whole lot more sense when we get to the kidneys, and that's going to be almost the last week in school. But I want to point it out to you now, so when I say it again, it sort of makes a little bit of sense. Okay. And you can get an inflammation of this space as well because your appendix is in the peritoneum. Sometimes that gets inflamed and infected, and if you don't get it treated, the appendix will burst open and all those bacteria and fluids are going to be released into the abdominal pelvic cavity, causing an inflammation. What would we call that inflammation? That's a peritonitis, right? Because it's within the peritoneal cavity. All right, those are all good terms for you to know. All right, so now I'm going to write on the board a general outline of some of these membranes. Right, you have them in your lecture notes, I think, in chapter 2, maybe. But now is a good time to talk about it. Membranes, there are two major kinds. There is a mucous membrane, and there is a second kind, a serous membrane. And we were talking about a serous membrane. Serous membrane has three parts to it. Who can remember some of the parts of a serous membrane? Okay, parietal. Parietal. All right, visceral. All right, visceral is the part of the membrane right on the organ itself. Parietal is going to be touching a body wall, for instance. And then you have the cavity. And inside the cavity, you have serous fluid. And now I need to tell you what a serous cavity is. A definition of a serous cavity is a cavity that is not open directly to the outside world. A cavity that is open to the outside world is your oral cavity. Okay? Your nasal cavity is open to the outside world, but the cavity that is holding your lungs, holding your heart, it's not open to the outside world. And you don't want the outside world touching your heart or your lungs or anything like that. A cavity that is open to the outside world is a mucous membrane. All right, so a mucous membrane will line your nasal cavity, oral cavity, reproductive tract, urinary tract, digestive tract. All of these tracts are open to the outside world, okay, and they don't have a serous membrane lining them. They have a mucous membrane. And a mucous membrane sometimes has a modified protein secreted onto it called mucus. All right, that's that stuff that runs out of your nose when you have a cold. And it helps kill bacteria. All right, mucus is also very slippery, acts like a lubricant. All right, so notice that I spelled these terms differently. Mucus, M-U-C-U-S, is a noun. That's the stuff. All right, when we use O-U-S over here, we use it as an adjective, as in the case of mucus, what? Membrane. So in this case, C-O-U-S is modifying membrane to tell you what kind of membrane it is, so it's used as an adjective. The spelling is a little bit different, okay, so you should be aware of that. All right, and we just got done talking about a cavity that's in a closed compartment inside your body that is housing visceral organs. That's a serous cavity, and it's got these different divisions of a serous membrane, visceral versus parietal membranes. All right, so now for sure, we're done with chapter 1. And we're going to move on to cytology. We're going to start talking about cells. Let's see, view, zoom, text width. Maybe that's a little bit better. Oh, I forgot. I could turn one of these lights off so you can see the slides a little bit better. How's that? Everybody can still see their own notes? Okay. So I think I showed you some pictures of cells already. Some of you have seen some of your own cells in your body in lab, except for one section. Okay. And can I move this over here? Oh, I can move it over here. Fantastic. I don't know what to do with this. I'll figure out what I want to do in a second. Oh, I can just click it down over here. Okay, so a cell. Here we see a general illustration of a cell, right, on the right-hand side, and it's got just about every organelle that we could think of to put inside a cell, and any cell in your body might not have all of these. It will have some of these organelles, but not absolutely every single one, but we want to give you an illustration that has more organelles rather than fewer so that you can get an appreciation for it. The first thing that you should appreciate is the cell membrane. Sometimes we call that a plasma membrane. A plasma is just something that's very fluid, not very strong. All right, so the cell membrane is very fluid. It can undulate. It can move around. And some cells actually are shapeshifters, and they change their shape, and they crawl around your body all the time, okay, by changing their shape. So the cell membrane is an organelle. I see other organelles in here, like a mitochondria. It has actually two membranes. Here's the outer membrane, here's the inner membrane. And the job of mitochondria is to make energy for the cell, the currency form of energy, which is ATP. All right, and then I see some sheets of membranes. With some of these sheets have no dots on them. Some have big dots on them over here. They're different kinds of membranes. They're called endoplasmic reticulum. This is called a rough endoplasmic reticulum because it has these dots. This is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Then there are vesicles that contain substances within inside the cell. We're going to go over some of these different kinds of vesicles. Another important organelle is the nucleus, because what does the nucleus contain? Yeah, genetic material in the form of DNA, and that is the blueprint on how to build your body. And in lab, we talk about if you know how your body is built, if you know the structure of your body, which is what we're learning in this class, what does that determine? What does the structure of your body determine? The function. That's right, because right now I'm using the mouse with my right hand, but if for some reason, oh, I could have damaged my hand very easily when I was younger, okay, because I worked in a machine shop. But look, I have all my fingers still. That's really good. But what happens if I did hurt my hand when I was growing up in a machine shop? What would happen to the function? I would have to be using the mouse with my left hand, right? So if you change the structure, you change the function of something, sometimes drastically. All right, so if you change the structure of this DNA inside the nucleus, guess what happens to the function of this cell right here? The shape changes, the function changes, and in all likelihood the cell would die as a result of that. So the structure is really important. It's protected. It's protected by the nuclear envelope or the nuclear membrane. That's a really important concept. Because there might be things in the cytoplasm over here that can damage the DNA. All right, so when we look at a cell, we see the cell membrane that separates the outside world from the inside living world. We see organelles, including this nucleus, and then there's also a fluid part inside the cell. We call that cytosol. Cytosol is the fluid living material inside the cell, and if we take cytosol and put organelles in it, then we get cytoplasm. Now, I don't know how your book is, if it caught up to modern terminology or not. Some people use cytoplasm just to talk about the cytosol inside the cell. Some people use cytoplasm just to talk about the organelles. But probably you should know that cytoplasm contains organelles plus cytosol, the fluid part. Okay. So the plasma membrane is an organelle. Let's spend some time with the plasma membrane. Oh, I do need to talk about one other thing. All right. The cell is the basic building block of all life, anywhere that we know it. As a matter of fact, we only know of life on this planet, but we'll probably learn very soon, certainly within 100 years, that there might be life on other planets in our solar system, or maybe on the moon, or someplace, another solar system. Okay, but life, as far as we know, is based on a cell. And a cell is defined as a particle. So here I see a particle, and you must appreciate some of the complexity. It must contain a cell membrane right here. It must contain cytoplasm, and that cytoplasm could be cytosol or organelles. It could be either one of those. And it must contain genetic material. Doesn't have to have a nucleus, but it has to have genetic material to be alive. Right? There are some infectious particles that have genetic material and a protein coat, but it doesn't have any cytoplasm. It has no cytoplasm, only has genetic material. So it can infect you, but is it alive? It's not alive. And a good example of that would be a virus. And that's why viral infections are so difficult to treat, because it's infectious, but it's not alive, and if it's not alive, how can you kill it? Doesn't make any sense. So viral infections are difficult to treat because we can't wipe them out, we can't kill them like bacterial infections, because a bacteria has cytoplasm and it has genetic material. Bacteria is a cell. So sometimes we call that what I call the structural and functional unit of life. I don't have that on here. The structural, so I could ask you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? If we have these structures right here that determines the function, how is all life put together? What's the basic building block? It's a cell right here, right? So that's how you would want to answer that. Okay, so as far as the cell membrane goes, right, it separates the outside world from the inside world. It's a barrier. It can select what enters the cell, what leaves the cell, and at what time. So it performs some pretty amazing functions. Its basic building block is this molecule right here. And this molecule right here. So when you look, get a general impression of the plasma membrane right here. How many layers does it look like it has? Yeah, just two layers. And that's how we describe a plasma membrane in its very nice simple nature, is a phospholipid bilayer. Bi mean two, bilayers. And so this is a phospholipid molecule. Here's the phosphate part, here's the lipid part, and it forms two layers. And in physiology, you'll see how that forms. It's pretty interesting how that forms. So a phospholipid bilayer can make a membrane. That's a nice basic way to describe any kind of membrane. But you see some other structures in the membrane as well. Some proteins that go across the membrane. This is a channel. So that's another thing that you should be aware of. This channel can open and close, and it will allow material to move through this channel at some times and then not at other times. Or it might allow maybe sodium to move through, but not chloride or not magnesium. So it can be selective in what it allows to move through the membrane. Okay, other kinds of compounds. Here's a cholesterol compound. It can dissolve in the phospholipid bilayer, and what it does, it kind of stiffens the membrane up a little bit. It gives it some structure, because this phospholipid bilayer is like an oil. So if we were to take a drop of oil, cooking oil, and put it in the top of a glass of water, what would happen to that oil? It would just float right on the top, right? It wouldn't dissolve into the water. And then if you were to tap that glass and start to get some wiggling and jostling of the water inside the glass, what would happen to the oil? Would it break apart, fracture, or what? It would just sit there right on the top of the water and kind of undulate as well. And cell membranes would do the same thing, but it has these pieces like cholesterol in there to give it a little bit more structure so that it's not quite so wiggly. All right, that's why they're in there. These proteins here can do the perform the same kind of function. And if they're peripheral proteins that go on the outside of the membrane, they can be connected to microtubules or filaments inside the cell then that give the membrane even more rigidity or a particular kind of structure. So this system down here can be used to determine the cell shape, can make it square or make it circular or make it columnar. And even some cells in your body can change their shape all the time. They're shapeshifter cells. Right, and they're crawling around inside your body looking for foreign substances, certain kinds of white blood cells. All right, other things are poking off the surface of the membrane, and things that are poking off the surface of the membrane might be what we call antigens. These are like little name posts right here that identify this cell as belonging to your body by their shape. So if they have this nice V shape right here, that might belong to your body. But if it looks more like a C or a B or maybe an A or something, then that signifies that that cell belongs to another person or another animal. So all of the people in your family will have antigens with about the same kind of shape. If you look at your cousins, it'll be a little bit different shape. If you look at somebody you're not related to, then the shape of those antigens are going to be even much more different. And it's the shape that makes the antigen different. And if a cell enters your body, if it has the wrong shaped antigen right here, what is your body going to do? It's going to reject it. It's going to fight it, right? You're going to develop an immune response to it, kill that cell so that it can't infect you. Okay, viruses, some viruses have antigens on them too. They can be identified by your body. So antigens, some of these proteins can be enzymes that will regulate chemical processes inside your body. Some of these proteins can be receptors, which means then it can attach molecules to a receptor, and then it's going to change the physiology of the cell. So that will be a signaling molecule, like a hormone. So a hormone will bind to a receptor, and it will signal the cell to change its activity. And other cells might have a receptor for a neurotransmitter. So when a neurotransmitter binds to it, it's going to change the activity of the cell, and if it's a muscle cell, it could go from a relaxed state to a contracted state. So these proteins on the surface of a membrane can change the activity of the cell. So these are all the different kinds of things that you can find inside the cell. Membrane channels, carrier molecules, some specific proteins can actually grab a molecule that's on the outside and force it to go to the inside. That's a carrier. Receptors we talked about, it binds a signaling molecule. Could be an enzyme that allows a chemical process to happen. Antigen we talked about, right? Structural supports we talked about. Exchange pumps, sometimes there's a protein that shoves one molecule out at the same time that shoves another one in, like sodium and potassium. So different kinds of other molecules besides the phospholipid can be incorporated into the membrane, and it has a very complex structure, which means it can have a very complex what? Function as a result of that, right? Okay, so a really good way to understand what a living membrane is not just a simple phospholipid bilayer, but because it's fluid, okay, and because it can have all kinds of different functions, because it has these different structures, we call that membrane, or we describe the membrane with the fluid mosaic model. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid, but it's a mosaic because a lot of other proteins and sugar molecules and even other lipids can be incorporated into the membrane to change its structure and thus its function as well. So membranes are pretty special. They're just not like saran wrap, okay, that's around maybe something that we have in the refrigerator. So here you can see that nice phospholipid bilayer that's easy to see. Okay. Rough endoplasmic reticulum. I think I'm going to go back maybe just to the regular picture of the cell. Okay, rough endoplasmic reticulum we see right here. I do want you to be able to identify these structures inside of a cell. This is an exam figure, and I would like for you to say, if I erase this from the figure and leave the lead line right here, I do want you to be able to label that as rough endoplasmic reticulum. And this is the nucleolus, and here we have chromatin, right? So that would be a typical exam figure. I don't know if I have a drag and drop in of this particular figure in Blackboard or not. Can't remember. Probably have some form of it. All right, I want you to be able to recognize this thing right here as mitochondria. So let's start talking about some of these organelles. Rough endoplasmic reticulum. We see the nucleus right here, and there's a system of membranes that curve around the nucleus. It has the same contours, curving around the nucleus, but I also see that it has these dots on it. And that tells me what the function of this particular membrane is. These dots are what we call ribosomes. And these ribosomes are bound to this membrane, making this membrane a rough membrane. So we call it rough endoplasmic reticulum. The function of rough endoplasmic reticulum is to synthesize a protein. So, and this membrane can synthesize a protein because the workbench that proteins are built on is called a ribosome. So here's a ribosome that's attached to endoplasmic reticulum, making it rough, but you could also have ribosomes that are floating around in the cytoplasm. Here's a free ribosome. Nonetheless, the job of this ribosome, whether it is free in the cytoplasm or attached to endoplasmic reticulum, is to make up protein. All right, so let's organize some thoughts. Protein belongs to a class of something, right? It's a class of chemicals that you have in your body. And a protein is one of these class of compounds. Another class of those compounds is called a sugar or a carbohydrate. So you have proteins, you have carbohydrates, and you have another class. And those are fats. So you got proteins, fats, carbohydrates, and then one last one that would be the genetic material, okay, ribonucleic acids or DNA, right, would be the fourth class of important biological compounds that you have in your body. You got proteins. Now, does anybody know what the building block of a protein is? Probably. Is amino acids make proteins? Okay, amino acids are joined together within a ribosome right here to make a protein. When you take some other classes, you'll have to learn the building blocks of lipids and the building blocks of carbohydrates, building blocks of nucleic acids, but I don't think we talk about that in here. But you should know what the building block of a protein is. Probably everybody did, right? It's an amino acid. All right, so that's endoplasmic reticulum. So if you see this structure, you should have at least one function on the tip of your tongue for the test. And so for rough endoplasmic reticulum, what would you say? Protein synthesis. Here is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Can it make a protein? And I see some people shaking your head. It looks like a no. And you're right. Why is that? Why can't smooth ER make a protein? Doesn't have a ribosome. Yeah. But it does make certain kinds of compounds, other important biological compounds, namely lipids. It can make a lipid. So it's important for lipid synthesis. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum sometimes can be used to store an electrolyte for us, an ion, and that's calcium, right? But probably at this stage right now, you should know that smooth ER is for synthesizing lipids, but it can also store calcium. Where else do you have calcium in your body, a storage form? All your bones store calcium for you as well. Calcium is a real important molecule in your body. It's stored in various places. In bone, it's also used to make bones strong, right? But that's probably not the most important reason for calcium. All right, what else do we have? Golgi apparatus. Here I see a Golgi apparatus. Do you see any ribosomes on the surface of the Golgi apparatus? No, I don't see any. I see some particles on the inside, but those are just molecules. They're not ribosomes. All right, so the job of the Golgi apparatus is as follows. When the rough ER makes a protein because of these ribosomes right here, those proteins are trapped within the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. They can't be floating around inside the cell anywhere. They're trapped within this maze inside the endoplasmic reticulum. And then some of that product, that protein, gets shifted to this little terminus right here, and this little terminus kind of buds off and forms a vesicle and is moved over to the Golgi apparatus, and the little vesicle then fuses with the Golgi apparatus so that whatever was on the inside of the endoplasmic reticulum is now on the inside of the Golgi apparatus. Probably you had some a little bottle of soap with a little hoop when you were a little kid, or maybe even last weekend, right? And you dropped that little hoop in there and waved it in the air, and what did it produce? A whole bunch of bubbles, because the soap film is a little bit stronger than the air. And a lot of times the bubbles might touch each other, sometimes they'll break, but every once in a while, what happens when those soap bubbles touch each other? Boop, it just forms a bigger one, right? And then a bigger one. Because the membrane, the soap bubble, has the same membrane. So the membrane here is the same as the membrane over here, so they can fuse together. And the synthetic process of rough ER now is inside the Golgi apparatus. And once it's inside the Golgi apparatus, it is modified. That's the key term. The job of Golgi apparatus is modification. It can take a protein and add a sugar molecule to it and make it a sugar-modified protein or protein-modified sugar. Sometimes we call that a mucopolysaccharide. And a protein with a sugar molecule that's added to it is actually mucus. Mucus is part protein, part sugar molecule. And since the structure changes, right, the function of mucus is pretty special. It's really slippery. It's got some other important processes too. All right, so then that mucus is made in the Golgi apparatus because the protein's been modified. It's been conjugated with a sugar molecule, and then it gets shipped out to the end of a Golgi apparatus right here and placed in another vesicle, and that vesicle then can hop a ride on a microtubule, move over to the cell membrane, and when it touches the cell membrane, what happens to those membranes? They fuse together again, just like those soap bubbles, and then whatever inside that vesicle gets secreted in outside the cell. We call that exocytosis. Right, secretion being released from the cell by a process we call exocytosis. So the Golgi apparatus is important for two reasons. One is modification, and the other is packaging. It packages that modified product so that it can be secreted from the cell. So modification and packaging, that's pretty important. And so this is the whole secretory sequence. Rough ER, Golgi, secretory vesicle, and then exocytosis. All right, we see the nucleus. It contains genetic material. It protects the DNA from being corrupted when the cell is doing its job. Here's a secretory vesicle. Secretory vesicles come from the Golgi apparatus. There are other vesicles that are floating around inside the cell, and they're all spherical. Maybe they have different colors, so they might be hard to identify. I'm looking for one over here. Here's a lysosome. A lysosome has some proteins in it, and maybe they're modified. So they come from the endoplasmic reticulum and Golgi body. And a lysosome has an enzyme called lysozyme. Lysozyme is an enzyme that can break large molecules into small ones. So it can digest large molecules. So for instance, if a bacteria runs and gets into the cell right here, maybe the cell says, oh, that bacteria I don't want in here because it's going to kill me. I'm going to take this lysosome, have it swallow the bacteria, and when the bacteria enters this lysosome right here, what happens to it? Yeah, it dies. It gets digested. So a lysosome is an intracellular digestive system. It can break large molecules and even cells down into smaller particles. Right? And when the shape of that particle gets broken down, what happens to the function? It stops as well, right? So if that bacteria gets lysed in a lysosome, then it can no longer be infectious. So it's one way to protect the happenings inside the cell. So lysosome is one kind of particle. It's for digestion. Here's another particle over here, peroxisome. It contains other kinds of enzymes for detoxification. That's the important term, detoxification. So you have some important kinds of vesicles. Some are for secretion, some are for digestion, some are for detoxification of harmful chemicals inside your body, right? And all of this is determined by the nucleus right here, because the function of those enzymes is determined by their structure, which is determined by the genetic material inside the cell right here. Lysosomes. Mitochondria. Let's look at mitochondria right here. Mitochondria is one membrane inside of another. It's a double membrane system. And its job is to make ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine triphosphate is the energy molecule. There may be a lot of energy molecules inside the cell, just like you might have a lot of valuables on your person. You might have a nice wedding ring that's made out of gold or platinum or something, so it's very valuable. It might even have a diamond on it, okay, makes it very valuable. But if you go to the grocery store, can you use your diamond ring to buy some ice cream? Sounds like it would be a good idea, right? Sometimes I'd rather have ice cream than a diamond ring, but it just doesn't work, okay? What do you need to buy ice cream? You need to have money. So then you got to take your ring someplace to somebody that will take your ring, convert it into money, to cash. Then you take the cash to any store you want, right? And they'll be happy to exchange whatever they have for money. So think of ATP as being the money molecule. You have a lot of diamond rings. You have a lot of energy inside the cell. But the form that's most useful for all these processes is ATP. So this mitochondria right here can take watches and diamond rings and convert it into cash or ATP for you, okay? Because that's the universal currency with inside of a cell is ATP. All right, other kinds of organelles. Here's a centriole. The centriole are two barrel-shaped structures. They're arranged perpendicular to each other. They're important because attached to them are microtubules and microfilaments and intermediate filaments. And these are long protein filaments that can attach to various kinds of proteins, determine the shape of the cell, but it also acts as a monorail system inside the cell. So these vesicles, like the secretory vesicle, when it moves from a Golgi apparatus to the cell membrane right here, it's got to hop onto a microtubule and hop a ride over to the cell membrane. So think of a microtubule as a monorail system inside the cell. And it's controlled by these centrioles. So when something has to be moved around or if the cell has to change shape, it's these centrioles that push and pull on these microtubules and makes things move around. On this particular illustration, we don't have the next three items, unfortunately. We don't have cilia, flagella, or microvilli. All right, but these are projections that are going to be coming off the surface of the cell. A flagellum is very long, can be maybe 5 or 6 times the length of a cell, and it acts like a little whip that whips around, which then is acting like a propeller, so that particular cell can actually swim around in a watery environment. There are such cells in the human body, but only one sex has them. What sex has a cell that can actually swim around? That's right, and that it would be a sperm cell, okay? So the function of a flagella is what we call motility. Motility is the ability to move around, right, within the environment, and a sperm can do that. There's another structure that's important for motility, but a little bit different, and that is a cilia projects off the surface of the cell. It has a very similar kind of internal structure as a flagellum, but it's very short, okay? It's maybe less than a tenth the length of a flagellum, but it moves, it whips as well. Human cells don't propel themselves with cilia, but if a cell has cilia, all the cilia are sweeping in the same direction all the time, so the cell doesn't move, but the fluid that's above the cell will then move in the direction that the cilia are sweeping. And it just so happens that all of our airways have cilia. They're lined with cilia, and the cilia are sweeping so that when we breathe in air, right, all the dust particles and bacteria, which the air is loaded with, gets trapped in some mucus that lines our respiratory tract, right? So it gets stuck before it gets into our lungs. And then which way do the cilia sweep all of that garbage? Up, that's right. You could think of it as sweeping it down, but then your lungs would fill up with all kinds of debris, right? So the cilia are sweeping up all the time, sweep that debris up into your oral cavity, and then what do? You swallow it down. Okay, unless you're a baseball player, then what do? Then you spit it out. Okay, but if you're not a baseball player, you can't spit in here. Okay, so another function, okay, for cilia right here is motility. The function of cilia is motility. Same as flagella, but there's a little bit of difference between them. The flagellum can move the cell, and cilia move things over the surface of a cell. A microvilli are even smaller projections coming off the cell membrane. We'll talk about what its function is in a great more detail when we get to different chapters, but it will be for absorption. It increases the surface area so that materials can move across the cell membrane. It makes the doorway bigger for movement across the cell membrane. Okay, some nuclear structures. Our nuclear structures inside the nucleus right here. You've got chromosomes. We can't see them at the moment, right? But you got a nucleolus. The nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus. We'll see what's happening there. There are also pores within the nucleus because there have to be materials that move from the cytoplasm into the nucleus and the nucleus into the cytoplasm, and the nucleus controls all that. All right, so think of the cytoplasm right here as cytosol with organelles, and nucleoplasm would be the genetic material with the fluid that's inside the nucleus. So just a little bit different compartment. Think of a cell as having two compartments, the nucleus and then the cytoplasm over here. All right, let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. There are two main processes. One is called passive transport, the other is called active transport. Passive transport does not require energy. It's a process that just automatically happens. And molecules, right, can move around without any help, without any energy source, but they have to move only in one direction. They can only move from high concentration to low concentration. So for instance, if we come in here first thing in the morning, air is pretty clean, there's not any kind of smell in the room or whatever, and I walk in with a perfume bottle, okay? And where's all the perfume at? It's inside the bottle and not in the room, right? If I open up the perfume bottle, it's going to evaporate from the bottle and it's going to dissolve in the air, okay? And then what's going to happen to that perfume? High concentration by the bottle, what's the concentration in the back of the room? Zero. It's going to be really low. So that perfume molecule is going to move from the front all the way to the back just because of that concentration gradient. Even though I don't feel any breeze, there's no fans in here, there's nothing moving the air around, every molecule is moving and jostling around, and that acts like a mixer to mix that perfume, right, evenly throughout the room. So if we leave the perfume bottle open all night long and come back first thing in the morning, if the perfume bottle's been open, guess what? We're going to smell perfume in the front, and where else are we going to smell perfume? In the back, and the concentration will be the same, because when the concentration is the same, then the perfume in the front won't move up to the back, and those that are in the back won't move up into the front. There's got to be a concentration difference in order for that to happen, and it does not require energy for that to happen. And we call that process diffusion, and that's because all molecules have some kind of motion stirring everything up all the time, even at the molecular level. All right, so things within a cell can diffuse by that same process. Things can even move across the cell membrane by diffusion. But let's just say something is going to enter the cell by diffusion. Where is the concentration high at? High outside, low inside, then all those molecules on the outside are just dying to get in, right, to the inside because there's low concentration. Now that's a special kind of process, okay? If it's a water molecule that's going from high concentration to low through the cell, we call that osmosis. Osmosis is a special condition of diffusion. It's the water molecule, and the water molecule can only go from high concentration to low, and it's got to go through a semi-permeable membrane, like this plasma membrane. Semi-permeable means that this membrane will let the water molecule go across and maybe a few other molecules, but not everything. Right? So osmosis means a semi-permeable membrane, water going from high concentration to low, and it doesn't require energy. So osmosis is a passive process. The other kind is what we call an active process. Active process requires energy. What's the universal form of energy inside your cells? ATP, right? So motion can take place as long as ATP is available. ATP, which stands for adenosine triphosphate. Tri means what number? Three, right? ATP gets broken down into ADP, which is diphosphate. How many phosphates are on ADP? Only two. So that means that one phosphate molecule came off, got broken off. There's a nice strong chemical bond in ATP, and when it breaks, it releases that energy for other kinds of purposes. So ATP is broken down into ADP, and then just a single phosphate that we call inorganic phosphate. That's why there's this little I right here. But there's something else also that's produced. There's another entity that's produced when ATP gets broken down to ADP and inorganic phosphate, and that is energy. Okay, that's a real thing, a real item, hard to describe, hard to think about sometimes. And in this particular case, we're talking about transport. That energy can be used to transport, right? Molecular transport, maybe there's a protein that can grab something on one side and change conformation and shove it to the inside. That requires ATP for that to happen. All right, but here's another way of moving across the membrane, using these vesicles. But it costs a lot of energy to change the shape of these membranes right here, because microtubules and filaments have to push and pull on the membrane to change its shape. That requires energy. All right, so for large molecules or big particles, we have these three processes right here. Phagocytosis is a process where a vesicle forms on the inside of the cell, and then whatever on the outside of the cell, we call that the extracellular space, kind of flows into the vesicle. The vesicle forms more and more and more, and then pinches away from the cell membrane, so that what was ever on the outside of the cell now is on the inside of the cell, inside of this vesicle. That is phagocytosis. And that just literally means cell eating. Cytosis is a cellular process. Phago means eating. Some bacteria have receptors on them that can be bind to receptors on the cell membrane that triggers this response of the cell. And the cell doesn't know that it's being infected. Yes. So we call that receptor-mediated endocytosis or phagocytosis. Sometimes that happens. So a good way to prevent that infection would be to come up with a drug that blocks that receptor, prevents that kind of infection. Okay. So phagocytosis is moving things inside the cell. Pinocytosis would be the exact same process, but instead of having solutes out here or particles out here, it would just be drinking fluid. So pinocytosis is cell drinking. Phagocytosis is cell eating. But in every case, something moves from the outside of the cell to the inside, and if it goes from the outside to inside, that is endocytosis. I would like to modify my notes right here. Endocytosis is what? Phagocytosis combined with pinocytosis. That's when something is entering the cell, right? And that means these membranes have to change shape, which means what? Is it a free process or a costly process? What does it cost you? It costs you ATP. Okay. Exocytosis is the reverse. So secretion is exocytosis. That's when there is a compound inside the cell that is secreted or exocytosed outside of the cell. That's how hormones get outside your body. That's how neurotransmitters get outside your body, okay, and other kinds of things. But that also requires energy for that to happen. Okay, protein synthesis. Remember, protein is one kind of important biological molecule that you have in your body. And proteins are built, right, the structure of a protein is built because the information is stored in the DNA inside the nucleus right here. All right, so DNA is a nucleic acid. It's another kind of important biological molecule, but it's different than a protein. It has a building block that we call a nucleic acid. What's a building block of a protein, once again? Amino acid, yeah. The building block of DNA is a nucleic acid. A little bit different kind of molecule. All right. Here is what we call the central dogma in biology, and I'm not even sure if many people teach this anymore. Okay, I'm a little bit archaic, so I like to talk about this, right? This shows how information is transferred within the cell. Information is stored. It's archived where? In the DNA inside the nucleus, right? That's the dictionary. That's the blueprint. It's got to be converted into another kind of nucleic acid that we call RNA, and then RNA is used to make a protein. So the structure of DNA determines what the structure of a protein is, which then means that, what can you tell me about this protein if it has a specific kind of structure? It has a specific kind of function associated with it, right? Now, how many steps does it take to take information from DNA to make a protein out of it? Right here, how many steps? Yeah, if you look at this illustration, how many arrows do you see? I just see two, which means it's a two-step process. We're going to learn the names of these processes. And what else could you tell me about this arrow right here? Can it go in both directions or only one direction? I meant it to be exactly as you see it, just one direction. It's a unidirectional process, right? So that's really handy. I find that really, really, really nice because the information that you have in your DNA, right, with this classical understanding, right, doesn't change over your lifetime. Right, so for instance, tonight when you have a chicken dinner and you eat all those chicken proteins that have chicken shapes to them, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak or feathers, right? Because the proteins in here can't determine what your DNA is like, because these processes are what? A one-way street. Can't go backwards. All right, so information only flows from DNA into RNA and then into a protein, never the reverse direction. All right, so let's talk about what these processes are called right here. This first step, DNA to RNA. The building block of RNA is called a nucleic acid. The building block of RNA is a nucleic acid. And that building block is the language of those particular molecules. So if you convert information, okay, from one language into the exact same language, which is a nucleic acid language, this is just the same information. What do we call that process? For instance, if you want to get a record of all of your grades that are in administration, and you want to have that exact same information, exact same form, so that you can pass it on to somebody else and say, hey, I deserve that job. What do you call that? That's a transcript, right? That process of making it is called transcription. So if you go from one language to the same language, that is transcription. So this first step right here is what we call transcription, because the building blocks of these molecules are the same. They're nucleic acids. All right, we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. I want to talk about the second step over here. What's the building block of a protein, once again? Amino acid. The building block of RNA is nucleic acid. The languages are different. This is a nucleic language in RNA. This is an amino acid language in a protein. What do we call that process that goes from one language to another? Maybe from Farsi to Hindi. That is called translation, English to Farsi. All right. And if you have a good translator, what can you tell me about the information, even though it's in two different languages? Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's reliable. It's the exact same information. It sounds totally different, but the information is exactly the same. Okay, so we call this second step right here translation. It changes the same information from a nucleic acid language into an amino acid language right here, but the information is not changed, right? So we call that translation. All right, so protein synthesis, two-step process, transcription, DNA to RNA. That happens inside the nucleus only, because where do you have DNA? Only in the nucleus. It's not out here in the cytoplasm, because if it is, it could become damaged. All right, and then once RNA is made, sometimes it moves through this nuclear pore out into the cytoplasm, and then the second step can take place. What's the name of the second step of protein synthesis? Translation, and it always is going to happen on a ribosome. That's where proteins are made. So proteins are made in the cytoplasm. RNA is made inside the nucleus because that's where DNA is found. All right, so there's all kinds of interesting things that you can understand about this two-step process over here. All right, so just remember, look up that word transcription in the dictionary. We'll look up that word translation in the dictionary, and that will help you become a little bit more familiar with these different processes, right? Transcription, translation. The sign-in sheet is going around. Next time, we might start with cell division just a little bit, but we talk about cell division quite a bit in lab, so I'll just run into it kind of briefly, but make sure you sign the sign-in sheet today before you leave. It's probably in the back of the room. And I'm going to turn some lights on. Be careful going down these stairs.